From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Protests today in Michigan and Minneapolis suggest a question. Has America truly moved the needle on civil rights since the 60s?
Unfortunately, some things haven't changed. What has changed is the use of technology, the fact that at any point in time, documentation of abuse can unfold and we can see images.
Also on the show, a high school senior talks about coping with so many things out of reach, job prospects, in-person college, and parents far away.
I'm trying to look into the future just to keep my head right, not thinking that it's going to last a long time.
Elsewhere, the clock is ticking on fall's NCAA sports schedule.
These are big, complicated machines, and you don't just flip a switch at Labor Day and have football the next week.
How long do Michigan's universities have to make their decisions? Those stories and more coming up on today's edition of Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, marches in Detroit and Ypsilanti draw attention to police use of force against African Americans. Once again, the country has to ask itself how Black lives are valued. Later on the program, thoughts from two Black Michiganders on what they see.
There has been for years this lingering notion that, well, if African Americans don't deserve this, then they're doing things or acting in ways that invite this, right? So we always hear the stories of the personal histories of Trayvon Martin or the personal histories of Rodney King or stories that tell us that people were violating the law or doing things that didn't make them appear to be just and proper, and then trying to tie that to why these moments of abuse have unfolded. Yet, in some of our contemporary examples, I mean, we've got a Black man trying to watch birds.
That conversation later in the hour. Also on the show today, we're wrapping up a series of conversations with Michigan high school seniors. They are still graduating and still making plans for their future during the pandemic. But first, college sports fans are trying to prepare themselves for an extended dry spell. Athletic directors and college presidents all over the region are trying to figure out what to do about sports like football. University of Michigan President Mark Schlissel told us last week at this time, while he's cautiously optimistic about some on-campus instruction this fall, he says he cannot imagine sports going forward if it's not safe enough for other kinds of campus operations.
If we are fully remote in the fall, if we can't find a safe way to bring students back to campus, we won't bring student athletes back to campus, so there won't be organized sports unless we can have an in-person semester. It just doesn't make sense to me to bring student athletes to campus when we're not allowing every other student to be on campus to pursue their education.
And the COVID-related growing pains continue to thread throughout the pro sports world. Michigan Radio sports commentator John Hugh Bacon joins us now to survey what is, I think, the most boringest season ever, right? That's what it is?
Easily. All teams suck right now.
So at the same time that the U of M is debating having a football season, Ohio State is trying to figure out whether or not to completely fill the stands. When do these decisions need to get nailed down for the Big Ten?
Sooner than later, because these are big, complicated machines, and you don't just flip a switch at Labor Day and have football the next week. You've got to get trainers, equipment, tape, food, you name it. That's all for July practice. So it's got to be done pretty soon, I think, probably the next few weeks. And you have noted that Ohio State is taking a different approach than Michigan is. Yes.
Well, and they are in a different place in terms of just number of COVID cases and everything. But still, I mean, do you think the differences between, these different habitats for COVID-19 around the Big Ten can be reconciled?
I really don't know. And you raise a great question there. Now, look, Ohio has done better than Michigan has with the rates, as I understand it. And of course, they're going back to practice June 8th. The state of Michigan does not open again till at least June 12th. So, and these disparities are going across the nation, obviously. Nebraska will be in much better shape to have football, obviously, than, say, UCLA or USC. So there's going to be a great disparity across the nation as to who responds and how.
On a somewhat related note, Coach Harbaugh sent out a two-page player's manifesto, as he called it, a couple of weeks ago. He had some things to say on a more macro level about eligibility for college players in the NFL and maybe what the colleges owe players that are such an important source of revenue. Did you see him saying anything vanguard?
What was Vanguard about it was that it came from a Power Five head coach. And you'll notice the crickets that have followed since then. Not one other coach has come on board with Jim. Almost everything he described should be, seems like to me, common sense. But they don't necessarily benefit the coaches. They benefit the players. Jim is also the guy who came across with the, what should be called the Harbaugh rule, but it's not, the one-time transfer without any explanation, no fake doctor's notes and so on, to transfer anywhere you want without explanation, without sitting out a year. And that has since been adopted. Now, Jim is not beloved by his many of his fellow coaches, so they're not going to call it that. But these rules he's proposing greatly empower the student athletes. And that does get kind of back to President Schlissel's point. It's pretty hard to ask them back on campus when you don't have the other students on campus either. So this will this might create a conflict there.
Maybe it's the perfect time to discuss larger scale changes like this. I don't know. Go ahead.
By the way, on that point, I agree with you strongly. Rahm Emanuel, the old mayor of Chicago, of course, and one of Clinton's. Rahm Emanuel, the former mayor of Chicago, had mixed reviews as the mayor, but he had a great line: never waste a great crisis. And in this case, you've got an opportunity here to create some real lasting reforms in college athletics, thanks to the situation that might occur that would not occur otherwise. So here's a chance.
Yeah. Among other things, Harbaugh suggested that any player who entered the NFL draft and was not drafted should be allowed to return to college. Do you think if the NCAA went for that, that that would be a widely used provision?
There are about 30 or 40 players every year who declare for the draft who don't get drafted. And then they're screwed because in the NCAA rules, once you've declared for the draft, it's a one-way street. You can't go back. And this is how crazy that is, April. In hockey and baseball, anybody good on campus has already been drafted, and they can decide for themselves to take that offer or not. So it's a total double standard in basketball and football versus baseball and hockey, which shows you the NCAA is not built on principles, but expedience.
Hey, speaking of the hockey game, we just learned that the NHL is going forward with plans to resume its season. When it does, the teams are going to move straight back into the playoffs. Who got shortchanged in that decision?
I would want to say the Red Wings, but they're not even good enough to get that close. So not them. Who got shortchanged? The teams that have already had a great season after 60 games. It's now pretty much everyone's equal who's in that playoff now. So it will be seeded, so the better teams will get a shot that way. But some of their good work will be kind of washed away. But it's not a bad plan overall. It's probably a pretty good idea. So they're going to try to finish the current season this summer, basically, and then go back to another season in the fall.
I got a little freaked out when I was looking at the plan, realizing the consequences of Canada's health policies. They've got a 14-day quarantine in that country. Any team wanting to cross the border to play has this waiting period because of COVID. John, what does this mean? Is the league going to have to pick its hub cities, and then everyone's just going to have to move a base of operations to those places?
That's what they're talking about doing. They've got 8 candidates for hub cities, and they're going to pick 2 of them, they say. I don't know how you can't pick one of them in Canada, since it's their sport and so many teams are there, of course. But the flip side is what you describe. Now, knowing the Canadian government, and I've had some experiences with them, watch them make an exception for about 200 hockey players. So,
wait, but it's not just the players. It's also their whole entourage, the teams and the coaching staff and everything, right?
That's true, and you're going to shrink the entourages, is my guess, which might not be a bad idea anyway. The expense of all this is crazy, of course. But I have a hunch Ottawa will look kindly upon hockey resuming.
Do you think that the league can actually start its regular season as scheduled in October?
Man, I'm not sure if any of this is going to work. If you're playing tennis, that's one thing. If you're playing hockey or football, I'm sorry, 6 feet of separation is not very likely, unless you're the Red Wings, of course. Or the Lions, for example.
Harsh.
I don't know how you can do this. I really don't know how you can do this. And look, all it takes is one guy to show up positive for that test. And the last 14 days, you know, his contact list is the entire league. Yeah, I don't know how you do it.
Yeah. Boy, all this talk of team sports. Who's looking smart for getting back to his running career now?
Is that what we're calling it?
I guess. Hey, man, you did the Boston Marathon.
I did the Bakeothon, the substitute, of course, around town,
of
my
course.
Parents' house, my current house. But I did lose 30 pounds, and yes, all my rinks are closed. So your husband and I can no longer play hockey right now. So thank God for running. It's the only game in town.
So let's play this out a little bit. What sports could you envision resuming? What about golf? Major League Soccer's been talking about trying to hold some in-person games as well.
Golf is the easiest by far. As you can tell, we can be on the golf course for 5 hours and have no idea how many kids you have. So it's a low contact sport, to say the least. So that one can be done. Tennis can probably be done. Depends on how they handle the tennis balls. But football and hockey, I mean, that is, you know, ultimate contact. And yes, sweat and spittle and all the rest get thrown around. So I don't know how you can do those sports.
What do you think about baseball's chances of coming back this year?
Better than hockey and football, based on the fact that it's virtually non-contact. That helps a lot. Basketball is going to try to bring all the teams to Orlando, Florida, and put them on a campus there. They're all going to be tested accordingly and have it basically quarantined in Orlando and have the whole season in Orlando. That's pretty crazy, but it might work.
John, we learned recently that Japan has decided Tokyo is going to try to host a revival games edition of the Olympics. I mean, given the size of what it takes to pull off regularly scheduled Olympics on a timetable that is practically a decade long, do you think this is just going to completely fritter the Olympic movement as we know it?
It's been under duress for a while anyway, but yes, this could really, really impact it. We're used to seeing them every 2 years now, of course. And like you say, if college football is complicated, it is nothing compared to an Olympic Games. And I've covered those. That machine has to be humming 6 years in advance at least. So that will be the hardest of all the things to resurrect.
Sports commentator John U. Bacon. He is the author of numerous books, including but not limited to The Great Halifax Explosion, a World War I story of treachery, tragedy, and extraordinary heroism. John, good talking to you.
Always, April. Thank you.
After the break, we're going to find out how one charter school operator is preparing for this fall. And we'll check in with someone else thinking about what might happen in autumn. A high school graduate trying to start college.
I'm trying to look into the future just to keep my head right, not thinking that it's going to last a long time.
We talk schools in the pandemic after the break. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Teachers and school administrators all over the state are in fast forward right now, trying to plan for the next school year. That's as true at charter schools as it is in Michigan's public school systems. As a result of COVID-19 and the closing of buildings, the state recently required schools to submit a continuity of learning and COVID-19 response plan in order to continue receiving state aid. Robert Kimball is an associate vice president for charter schools for Grand Valley State University. We called him up to find out what their plan looks like. Rob, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks, April.
So you've identified three scenarios for what school might look like going forward to next fall. Can you run us through what each one looks like?
Yeah, so we've asked all of our 78 schools to do some proactive scenario planning. We've asked for three specific scenarios. One, completely virtual, when no in-person contact is allowed. Two, a hybrid approach, when limited contact could be allowed. And a full in-person experience, as close to what we could get to as normal now. And within each of those scenarios, we've leaned on what our colleagues across the globe are doing as they reconsider opening schools in a COVID-19 environment. And that looks widely different across the globe right now. And the Michigan educators that we work with are looking at some of those examples and crafting scenarios to how they might plan to be able to serve students in the fall within each of those three ways.
Would you say that the process of retooling has happened any faster or even just differently within charter schools because of the way that they operate?
Well, I think charter schools by nature no family or student is ever forced to be in a charter school. So charter schools, by design, are highly sensitive to the interests of families and students. And that's not to say that traditional public schools or private schools are not sensitive to families' interests. That's just to say by design, based on the idea that our charter schools have to meet enrollment targets and understand and connect with families, we've seen our charter schools really rise to the occasion and build that connection with families in this moment. And you're seeing them do that in really innovative ways.
So as you've said, you've identified these three different scenarios in which schools might operate in person, completely remotely, or as a bit of a hybrid. Can you talk a little bit about what the challenges and considerations might be for each of those different possibilities?
You know, at this point, it's really hard to offer conjecture because that's just what it would be at this point. I think the hybrid approach is really difficult because a core value of the charter model is equity and equitable education for all, educational opportunities. And so one of the variables that we keep hearing tossed around again and again in the hybrid approach is that some students can come at certain times and other students will be remote. And that's concerning from the standpoint of we want to provide the same opportunities for all students. And we want to make sure that equity is at the fundamental bedrock of our designs going forward.
Right. So are you saying that, for example, you can't really say with certainty at this point what the hybrid would look like because there are so many things that would need to be worked out to ensure that students are getting the same opportunities across the board?
That's right.
Right. It sounds like that's similar to some of the conversations happening in Michigan's public schools right now.
I think educators are united in this moment, wherever they are, to solve some amazingly complex problems. And one of the great findings we had in our independent study of our continuity of learning plans was the fact that educators in this moment are being incredibly resilient and rising to the occasion and innovating, solving problems for families, not just in the instructional paradigm, but also in the non-instructional paradigm and connecting and providing that socio-emotional support for families.
Rob, one of the things that public schools have become a hub for since the pandemic began are things that aren't necessarily thought of as a part of education's mandate, meal distribution, and a plan to get technology into the hands of every student at home, in the case of Detroit Public Schools Community District. Can charter schools help families keep up with the needs that are falling through the gaps in the larger system in the way that Detroit has been? Or are there other ways that we might think about access to those things among students for charter schools?
Yes. So out of GVSU's 78 schools, 56 of them are serving as food distribution hubs. We worked hand in glove with all of our Detroit stakeholders and stakeholders across the state to ensure that all of our students were having access to quality nutrition. And then as far as device access and connectivity, it's been inspiring to see the educators dig into resources and connections to connect their students and families with those resources, whether it was boosting signal strength in parking lots to opening up surplus stores at the university to push out all the unused laptops to our homeless and dropped out students, to buildings leaning on teachers to have them individually order with school resources the maximum allowable number of devices through Staples, and then pool those resources and get those devices out to families. It's been an incredible story of the resilience of educators at this moment.
How can schools that GVSU authorizes keep staff and teachers and students safe? For example, is PPE something that you're talking about with respect to next fall?
Certainly, we're waiting for the official guidance on how what PPE expectations are to keep students and staff safe. And you can be sure that that charter schools, just as traditional schools and private schools, will be keeping student safety and staff safety at the top of their priority list as we start to think about what does learning look like going forward.
Do you feel like the timeline that exists right now for planning for fall is going to be realistic?
I think there's so many unknowns. I think educators feel an urgency to be able to continue to serve students well, particularly our highest need populations, where students may be best served by being in the classroom. And there's a number of unknowns, but there is some certainty, and that is the certainty that we know that educators are really ready to go with us and be able to educate students as best as they can this fall, regardless of the uncertainties at the moment.
What do you think the pandemic means for the future of the way we understand education?
I think we're going to, just as cell phones were really clunky at the beginning, distance learning was really clunky. It was difficult to understand the expectations and how things worked away from in-person instruction. And I think there'll be a greater comfort level with distance learning. I don't think snow days will ever be the same.
Rob Kimball is an associate vice president for charter schools for Grand Valley State University. Rob, thanks for your time.
Thanks, April.
This week, we've been speaking with members of the class of 2020. High school seniors are in such a weird place. They have all the concerns that younger kids have about friends and this moment transitioning into a different place in social life, plus the many adult worries about the pandemic and its deep economic ripples. Makes for anything but a fun summer, right? Today, we're catching up with Rodrigo Lopez Ruiz. He's a senior at Wyoming High School in West Michigan, and he joins us now. Hey, Rodrigo, welcome to Stateside.
Hey, how you doing, April?
Well, I'm all right. How about yourself? Is everyone in your family safe right now?
Yeah. Fortunately, the virus hasn't got to anybody I know personally. So
yeah,
that's good.
I can't believe what this must be like for you. Not only are you graduating during a global pandemic and trying to wrap up your high school career, but you've also been working at a hospital as a food service worker. What have the past couple of months been like for you?
Well, working at the hospital, at first, it got really, really slow. So for the first month, I don't think we had any COVID patients. But after that, then I started seeing more people come in. They turned the whole unit and they filled it up with COVID patients out of nowhere. Like, that's when it hit me. When I seen a lot of people came in, that's when I was like, Oh, this is really a real thing. This is really happening.
For sure. I mean, you probably had to deal with a little different situation in the work environment in terms of the things you had to do yourself to stay safe, I'm guessing. Would you say that being a frontline worker in that way, would that caused a lot of anxiety for you?
Yes. Coming in, I feel like I was more exposed to be able to get the virus. So, like, I try to stay as safe as possible. You know, I didn't want to bring it around. I didn't want to bring it home. I didn't want to bring it to my grandma or nobody.
What was your reaction when you realized that there was not going to be a graduation as originally planned?
Well, my first thought, I got really sad because I feel like I've been waiting for this moment for so long. I can remember back to like middle school, just like, oh, I want to be a senior. I want to graduate. I remember going to graduations like throughout high school of like classes that already graduated. And I was just like, that's going to be me in 2 years. That's going to be me next year. And then I got to it and I was like, boom, it's gone. It hit me. But then they let out the news a couple weeks ago that they're planning on having graduation July 28th. So hopefully that goes on. Might not be normal, like might just be limited people, but it's better than nothing.
We're hearing this from a couple of different schools that they might try to, you know, put ceremonies off until July in the hopes that there'll be, you know, the infection rate will be low enough by then that there won't be really be a risk and that people can be there in person. Do you feel like you're kind of mentally preparing yourself in case that doesn't go off as planned as well?
Yeah, I don't know. It feels like I went from just being a high school student to like I'm just done with school. So I already went through the phase that I was like, oh, I'm not graduating. So if it doesn't happen, it's not going to hit me as hard as it did the first time. It's going to hurt to not graduate from high school, but I'm just looking down a bright side. I'm closer to graduate from college.
So your mom and your little sister are in Mexico. They moved down when you were still, I think, a sophomore in high school. I know your mom had originally planned to come up this month for graduation. What was her reaction when you told her that the ceremony wasn't going to happen then?
She was a little sad, but the plan now is that after the July ceremony, my plan is to go down there and spend time with her and my little sister, because my little sister was probably the saddest. It was heartbreaking news to her because she was like waiting. She was just waiting for like to see me. So,
you know, the situation in Mexico City is getting pretty intense right now. The hospitals are getting that overwhelm that some of us here know all too well from COVID cases. I know that they live a little outside the city, but do you feel nervous about traveling?
Yeah, I do. She lives outside the city, a little far from the city, so she said it's not bad there. But when I go, I want to go out and be able to visit places. So I'm just waiting to book my plane ticket. And if anything, I'll just go during the holidays. Because my plan was to go also in December, go down like right when winter break starts, because then I'll be able to get there for my mother's birthday, my little sister's birthday, and Christmas and New Year's and all that.
What's it been like being separated from them right now?
Oh, it's hard. It's hard because like sometimes she'll call me, I'll be busy, I'll be at work, so I can't communicate with her. And then when I call her back, she doesn't get all the best service. Sometimes I'm able to communicate with her. Sometimes I got to wait a couple of days to be able to talk to her, make sure she's all right. So it gets really hard sometimes, not knowing if she's fine at the moment.
I'm sure those spaces between conversations must seem pretty long.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk more about your plans for the fall. I know that you were initially pre-COVID, I should say, the plan was to try to get enrolled in a community college, right?
Yeah. Well, my first option was to try to head up to MSU right away. But when everything hit, I just decided to stay home for one more year. So now my plan is to get enrolled into GRCC. But one of my classes already got moved online, so I'm hoping to see how that's going to turn out.
It seems like you might still get to have sort of a college freshman experience next year if this is all passed. Is that something that you're looking forward to?
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that just because I didn't get to finish my senior season, like actually go out and like go out with friends and do all the senior activities. I'm looking forward to doing all the kind of freshman activities, like go out and explore, go hang out, make new friends, get involved on campus.
This seems so different than the way a lot of people coming out of high school imagine their time right now. How do you keep yourself going through what you need to do day to day without just getting bogged down in the fact that part of the world is kind of on lockdown for the moment?
Well, I try to keep a positive mindset. I usually have a routine, daily routine, get up, go for a little jog just to stay in shape, spend time with family. I usually go to work. I just started also working at Walmart too because I'm planning on leaving the hospital. So
is there anything that you're doing to just keep yourself from going stir crazy and being bored inside right now?
I feel like I call people like I call my whole contact list like two times a day just to talk to somebody. Since I can't really hang out, I just start calling random people, just check up on them, see how they're doing, just to get a conversation going. I think they're getting tired of me, but as long as I don't get bored, I'll just keep calling them.
Are a lot of your friends in a situation right now where they're, you know, they same as you, where like they're working and they had planned to do work over the summer before maybe trying to transition to something academically this fall?
Yeah. So a couple of them decided just to stay at GRCC for 1 year, but I know a couple of them, their plan is still to leave for the fall, but they're still waiting on to see how that everything's going to work out. They don't know if they're going to be allowed on campus or if sports will even be allowed, because some of them play sports, so they're still waiting to see if they will be able to play their sports or how everything's going to work out. So it's just, it left us with a lot of questions, you know.
Well, Rodrigo, thanks for talking to us about everything going on right now, and we wish you luck. I hope you manage to make it to see your mom and your sister this summer.
Yep, that's the plan, but thank you for having me.
Rodrigo Lopez Ruiz is a senior at Wyoming High School in West Michigan. Hearing Rodrigo talk about his work and his family, it really feels so true that a lot of the people most in harm's way right now are young people. We're so grateful that they're standing up and getting through this, figuring out ways to contribute and to get their lives started. We'd like to wish everyone in the class of 2020 all the best. Coming up, we'll talk about the protests against excessive force by police planned today in a couple of Michigan cities and elsewhere across the country. We'll hear from a sociologist and a law professor in just a minute. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Additional protests are planned today in Detroit and elsewhere in the wake of explosive uses of police force against African Americans in Minnesota and in Southeast Michigan. The death of George Floyd of Minneapolis in police custody has ignited feelings on the national stage after video surfaced of an officer with his knee on Floyd's neck before his death. Another video showing a Washtenaw County deputy repeatedly punching Shatina Grady L. in the head when she refused to leave the scene of a shooting recently brought home the truth that African-American Michiganders know all too well, that justice is systematically applied in different ways and that Black lives are not always valued equally. Joining us today are Alford A. Young, professor of sociology at the University of Michigan. He's also associate director of the U of M's Center for Social Solutions. He's coming to us from his home in Ann Arbor. Professor Young, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And Tracy Brame is with us as well. She's a professor and associate dean at Western Michigan University's Cooley Law School, Grand Rapids campus, and she is in Grand Rapids today. Professor Brame, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
I have a question I'd like to ask both of you starting out. When you look at images of the protests in Minneapolis, what do you see? Tracy, you worked as a public defender in both Detroit and Washington, D.C. May I start with you?
Absolutely. So I came of age. I was actually at University of Michigan as an undergraduate student when Rodney King was beaten by officers out in L.A., and I remember the riots that followed and the images that I saw in Minnesota and elsewhere kind of brought me back mentally to that time. And it was, you know, gut-wrenching for obvious reasons, but you know, not the least of which is that, you know, 30 years later, we're facing the same issues. So it was tough.
Al, what about you? When you're viewing what's happening a few states over, what comes up for you?
Well, it seems like here we go again. And that, I think, is a sentiment not just of people in Michigan, but across the country. There's a real strong connection to that situation, because even though it's happening there, it seems like what we've seen so often in so many other parts of the United States.
Yeah. Al, you published a book last year about African-American communities in Ypsilanti. When people see images of a Black woman getting punched in the face by a sheriff's deputy, what informs how citizens digest what they're seeing? What are some of the broader issues in history that might be on their minds?
Well, in the first case, it's this continued living a contradiction. And on the one hand, people, Black people too, want to see the police, want to see law enforcement as servants of the public interest. Yet people feel, particularly Black people, feel threatened by the police and law enforcement when they come into communities, assault people, punch people. I mean, it's clear that all kinds of people get angry around issues. We're seeing that in some other kinds of protests in the country, including our state capital in Michigan. But the response to be assaulted by the kinds of people you expect to protect and serve you, is what just heightens anger and frustration.
It feels like this pattern that recurs again and again begins with outrage and media attention. In recent years, we've seen more incidents of officers being arrested, sometimes charged, sometimes even disciplined. But there have been actually very few convictions. Tracy, can you provide a little context about what's happening inside the justice system? That even though police departments have been going through different forms of training, even though there has been heightened scrutiny on these incidents, why is it, in your view, that the pattern is recurring?
Well, I think there's a couple of things going on. And I think, you know, Dr. Young put it well, there's this expectation that law enforcement is there to serve, to protect, to investigate, to solve crimes, et cetera. So I think that there's a certain credibility that officers receive that they have to have, right, in order to do their jobs. And sometimes that gets in the way of discipline and prosecution, even in the most heinous cases. But more fundamentally, I think that these most recent cases and the ones that, you know, seem to keep coming up monthly, yearly, you know, what have you, in which white officers are seeing using excessive force against people of color, it is an outgrowth of, you know, the centuries of racism and discrimination and lack of respect for black life. And, you know, I'm teaching a class at the law school called Race in the Supreme Court, where we look at how the legal system has dealt with issues of race going all the way back, right, to slavery times, and how the courts have dealt, you know, have grappled with how formerly enslaved people now coexist with the people that enslaved them. And needless to say, it's been a bumpy road, but the legal system has been able to patch together a system where there are at least laws in place to react to things like this, right? There's laws in place stating, you know, that people shouldn't be discriminated against on the basis of race or gender or sexual orientation, that, you know, everybody has a right, equal right to housing, equal right to vote, et cetera. But there's only so much that the law can do, right? So, you know, we can prosecute these officers, and I hope we do. I hope that they're disciplined. You know, I hope that the truth comes to light, et cetera. But the law can't touch, unfortunately, that fundamental problem of the lack of respect that our country still has for people of color and the like. George Floyd automatically seen, you know, as dangerous criminals to be subdued.
Tracy, it seems like one of the main legal points of conflict, although, you know, these cases never come head to head with each other, has to do with the fact that court precedent tells police officers that if they feel endangered, that is the basis for making decisions on use of force. Why do you think it is that the courts have, you know, the public has clearly reacted to seeing use of force being used in ways that we can agree are excessive again and again. Why is it that the courts have not recognized that?
Well, again, you know, there has to be a standard, because like I stated before, police officers have to have a certain amount of discretion and perspective in order to do their jobs, right? And if they do feel as though they're in danger, they have to be able to neutralize, right, have the room to neutralize that danger in any given situation. Again, the problem is, and I'm not sure that it's one for the courts to solve, and I'm sure Dr. Young can speak to this, the problem is the context in which people feel as though they're in danger, right? And it takes a lot less for police officers to feel endangered by a black suspect than by other people, right? And I think, you know, we saw even a more innocuous yet troubling example in Central Park, you know, earlier this week, you know, where a woman was confronted by
Amy Cooper.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, he was bird watching and asked her to leash her dog, and, you know, she confronts him about it. And one of the first things she does is says, "If you don't leave me alone, I'm going to call the police and tell them that there's an African-American man threatening me." And she says that. She knows exactly what she's doing. She does it purposefully because she knows that that will get a reaction, that there's something about saying that there's an African-American man threatening me somehow heightens the danger, right? And again, I think that many police officers feel the same way, either consciously or subconsciously. And if we don't deal with that, then we're going to be faced with the same situation over and over again, where somebody gets hurt or killed, and the police officer's response is, "Well, I thought I was in danger," right? No matter how, you know, even if it was, you know, some man that was alleged to pass a counterfeit $20 bill, right? You know what I mean? Certainly, we have to address it judicially, but there's a lot of extrajudicial work that we need to do.
If you're just joining us, our guests today are Tracy Brame, Associate Dean of Western Michigan University's Cooley Law School in Grand Rapids, and Professor Al Young of the University of Michigan School of Sociology. Al, the context of what's happening right now in the country with a pandemic is just really, I don't know, it feels striking to me at a time when African-American communities in Michigan and elsewhere have absorbed a disproportionate share of the infection rates, of the death rates. Do you think that that adds to the frustration that we're seeing in some of the protests?
Well, it certainly does, because all of the protests, irrespective of a focus on people coming to Lansing to protest stay at home, or Black Americans protesting the abuse that they're suffering at the hands of white people, all of these are about claims around citizenship. And for Black Americans, particularly around COVID and the heightened effect that this has had on the Black community, the response has been, are we cared about? Are resources being brought to bear to address this issue? Are we getting government and societal responses that one would expect a citizen should have? At the same time, the other people that feel that their rights as citizens enable them to take guns to state capitals or speak out aggressively over and against government-supported policies, right? The stay-at-home orders, what have you. In their case, it's almost as if the citizenship is being taken for granted. I can act in this way because I'm duly obligated to do so as a citizen. Whereas for African-Americans, unfortunately, the protest activity, a strong claim for recognition as citizens, a strong claim that legal authorities, health and healthcare systems should engage Black folks as American citizens. So the protests, as far as Black Americans are concerned, are about claims to be recognized as appropriate citizens, yeah, not simply acting on one citizenship, as is the case for people in Lansing and the others who are going to state capitals with guns in hand.
Just to dive into the deeper history for a moment, Black communities across the country have been protesting excessive use of force for decades. I mean, here in Michigan, the Detroit Uprising of 1967 was, you know, a sort of a standard for the anger and outrage of the Black community. Do you think anything has truly changed coming out of those events as we look back to 1967 and now to 2020? Al, could you start?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, some things haven't changed. What has changed is the use of technology, the fact that at any point in time, documentation of abuse can unfold and we can see images of what's going on, has been a radical change. So there are people that would not believe that Black Americans have been subjected to certain kinds of abuse that are seeing consistent reminders that that abuse unfolds. I think, unfortunately, what has not changed, but as evident by some of the recent cases, has gotten more severe, is that there has been for years this lingering notion that, well, if African Americans don't deserve this, then they're doing things or acting in ways that invite this, right? So we always hear the stories of the personal histories of Trayvon Martin or the personal histories of Rodney King, or stories that tell us that people were violating the law or doing things that didn't make them appear to be just and proper, and then trying to tie that to why these moments of abuse have unfolded. Yet in some of our contemporary examples, I mean, we've got a Black man trying to watch birds. The very social functioning of Black folks contemporarily really flies in the face of this historic pattern of trying to say, well, that person may have been up to no good at some time, therefore, there's some justification for the abuse that happened when it did.
Yes.
Tracy, it's gotten worse today. It's gotten worse.
Tracy Brame, do you think we can honestly say that the country has moved forward?
No, I have to agree with Al. And, you know, and I'd be remiss if I didn't say, you know, certainly we made strides in some areas. I was born in 1970, just after the riots in Detroit. And you know, thanks to the hard work of my parents and a lot of other people, I've been able, you know, to go to college, to go to law school, become a lawyer, et cetera. But that's always been true for some of us, right? The vast majority, though, at least too many people, let me put it that way, too many people in the Black community just still, all these years later, don't have those opportunities. So to take it back to what Al said about, you know, fighting to be treated as citizens, that's been the case from the very beginning, right? From the founding of our nation, that, you know, people of African descent were not considered citizens and had to literally fight for a 14th Amendment to even be considered equal citizens of this country. And that journey, right, still lingers. And so, you know, I'll go back to what I said before, unless and until, right, and you can even take all the pictures you want, right? You know, like I said, we do have more media now, you know, more contemporaneous in, you know, in the moment views of what's happening. But until we reckon with the underlying reasons that it's happening, it's just not going to change. Because as Al said, people are going to try to excuse it away, right? Even when we whittle down to bird watching, you know, they're going to try to, you know, to find some justification for what happened that absolves, you know, the perpetrators of guilt. And they're hard conversations, right? Like sometimes when I try to talk to my white contemporaries, it's not an easy conversation. People don't want to, you know, have these kind of victim aggressor type of conversations and be made to feel guilty and be made to feel uncomfortable and all those kind of things. But I believe that it's a necessary and essential step to move forward, to say, you know what, you know, I understand that these years of discrimination and terror, you know, faced by these communities, I understand the protests and they're going to keep happening, because you mentioned it at the top when you said that something major will happen and there'll be protests and everybody be angry and then we'll move on.
Yeah.
And then it happens again. Right. You know what I mean? And it just becomes this cycle, and it'll continue to be that way unless somewhere along the way we can establish a sustained commitment to you know, not only to being reactionary when this happens, but to be proactive in actually improving the state of relations between people in the country and the state of being of African Americans.
Al, you brought up the fact that a few weeks ago, hundreds of protesters came to Lansing, almost exclusively white protesters, to make their voices heard about mobility and freedom with guns at hand. What happens when black citizens demand the same?
Oh, boy. I don't want to imagine what happens. We already see in the reaction to the violence that unfolded in Minneapolis, you know, what happens around protests. So most black Americans that I've talked to, and I've had a lot of conversations around the Lansing protests and similar activities, were just in awe of the fact that people could comfortably show up with guns when they themselves felt just showing up would be the source of a problem. Showing up with picket sign in hand, showing up with one's body would be enough to invite a hostile reaction. So there's just an extreme response to just how very different we stand in this country around what we think we're entitled to do, how we think we can act and operate in public space, and what we imagine will be the consequences for doing so.
Tracy, we just have maybe a little more than a minute left here. Do you have thoughts on why, with the officer in Minneapolis, justice is systematically applied in different ways?
Probably the same reason as always. The prosecutor's office wants to take it slow, wants to gather evidence, et cetera. I will tell you that one of the things that I'm seeing here is that varying people at different stages of law enforcement are calling this a murder already, right, which is something that you don't always see, that usually there's a can't rush to judgment, we got to see the other side, et cetera. And while the county attorney...
Including Police Chief James Craig.
Exactly. So while the county prosecutor attorney is trying to, hopefully, right, trying to build his case, right, and making sure that they have a good case going forward, because we saw what happened, you know, with Freddie Gray, how to unravel, trying to make sure that he has an airtight case, already from the Justice Department on down, right, from the AG in Minnesota on down, people are recognizing this for what it was, right, you know what I mean,
yeah.
Which is the unlawful taking of life, of a human life. And so I have seen more calls for arrest for more quarters than usual, but it's not uncommon, you know, particularly when police officers are involved because of the standards around excessive force and, you know, and the investigation that's needed. They were fired right away, which, again, you know, with, you know, they skipped administrative leave and internal affairs and all that and just fired them. So
right.
There is some movement there. But I hope that this is a tipping point because I just, you know, the community just can't keep taking this. I don't know what to say. I have a 13-year-old son who'll be 14 in July, and every time this happens, the older he gets, the more scared I get. Just, you know, hoping that by the time he's an adult, you know, that he doesn't have to, you know, got to worry about walking down the wrong street. So,
Tracy Brame is Associate Dean of Western Michigan University's Cooley Law School in Grand Rapids. We've also been talking with Professor Alfred Young of the Sociology Department at the University of Michigan. Thank you both so much for taking some time with us today, and we're wishing you both a safe weekend.
Thank you
so much. Thank you. I appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
That's Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. See you Monday.